censorship continued. It did not refer to their marriage, but just said she hoped to resume their old relationship now that their countries were at peace. Perhaps the letter was risky all the same. But she was desperate to find out whether Walter was alive, and, if he was, to see him. She feared that the victorious Allies would want to punish the German people, but Lloyd George's speech to Liberal MPs that day was reassuring. According to the evening papers, he said the peace treaty with Germany must be fair and just. "We must not allow any sense of revenge, any spirit of greed, or any grasping desire to overrule the fundamental principles of righteousness." The government would set its face against what he called a base, sordid, squalid idea of vengeance and avarice. That cheered her up. Life for the Germans now would be hard enough anyway. However, she was horrified the following morning when she opened the Daily Mail at breakfast. The leading article was headed, "The Huns Must Pay." The paper argued that food aid should be sent to Germany, only because if Germany were starved to death, she could not pay what she owes. The Kaiser must be put on trial for war crimes, it added. The paper fanned the flames of revenge by publishing at the top of its letters column a diatribe from Viscountess Templetown, headed, "Keep Out the Huns." "How long are we all supposed to go on hating one another?" Maud said to Aunt Herm. "A year? 10 years? Forever?" But Maud should not have been surprised. The Mail had conducted a hate campaign against the 30,000 Germans who had been living in Britain at the outbreak of war, most of them long-term residents who thought of this country as their home. In consequence, families had been broken up, and thousands of harmless people had spent years in British concentration camps. It was stupid, but people needed someone to hate, and the newspapers were always ready to supply that need. Maud knew the proprietor of the Mail, Lord Northcliffe. Like all great pressmen, he rarely believed the drivel he published. His talent was to express his readers' most stupid and ignorant prejudices as if they made sense, so that the shameful seemed respectable. That was why they bought the paper. She also knew that Lloyd George had recently snubbed Northcliffe personally. The self-important press lord had proposed himself as a member of the British delegation at the upcoming peace conference, and had been offended when the Prime Minister turned him down. Maud was worried. In politics, despicable people sometimes had to be pandered to, but Lloyd George seemed to have forgotten that. She wondered anxiously how much effect the Mail's malevolent propaganda would have on the election. A few days later, she found out. She went to an election meeting in a municipal hall in the East End of London. Eth Leckwith was in the audience, and her husband Bernie was on the platform. Maud had not made up her quarrel with Ethel, even though they had been friends and colleagues for years. In fact, Maud still trembled with anger when she recalled how Ethel and others had encouraged Parliament to pass a law that kept women at a disadvantage to men in elections. All the same, she missed Ethel's high spirits and ready smile. The audience sat restlessly through the introductions. They were still mostly men, even though some women could now vote. Maud guessed that most women had not yet got used to the idea that they needed to take an interest in political discussions. But she also felt women would be put off by the tone of political meetings, in which men stood on a platform and ranted while the audience cheered or booed. Bernie was the first speaker. He was no orator, Maud saw immediately. He spoke about the Labour Party's new constitution, in particular Clause 4, calling for public ownership of the means of production. Maud thought this was interesting, for it drew a clear line between Labour and the pro-business Liberals, but she soon realized she was in a minority. The man sitting next to her grew restless and eventually shouted, "Will you chuck the Germans out of this country?" Bernie was thrown. He mumbled for a few moments, then said, "I would do whatever benefited the working men." Maud wondered about the working woman, and guessed that Ethel must be thinking the same. Bernie went on, "But I don't see that action against Germans in Britain is a high priority." That did not go down well. In fact, it drew a few scattered boos. Bernie said, "But to return to more important issues." From the other side of the hall, someone shouted, "What about the Kaiser?" Bernie made the mistake of replying to the heckler with a question. "What about the Kaiser?" he rejoined. "He has abdicated. Should he be put on trial?" Bernie said with exasperation, "Don't you understand that a trial means he will be entitled to defend himself? Do you really want to give the German Emperor a platform to proclaim his innocence to the world?" This was a compelling argument, Maud thought, but it was not what the audience wanted to hear. The booing grew louder, and there were shouts of, "Hang the Kaiser!" British voters were ugly when riled, Maud thought. At least the men were. Few women would ever want to come to meetings like this. Bernie said, "If we hang our defeated enemies, we are barbarians." The man next to Maud shouted again, "Will you make the Hun pay?" That got the biggest reaction of all. Several people shouted out, "Make the Hun pay!" "Within reason," Bernie began, but he got no farther. "Make the Hun pay!" The shout became common, and in a moment they were chanting in unison, "Make the Hun pay! Make the Hun pay!" Maud got up from her seat and left. 3. Woodrow Wilson was the first American president ever to leave the country during his term of office. He sailed from New York on December 4th. 9 days later, Gus was waiting for him at the quayside in Brest, on the western tip of the Brittany Panhandle. At midday, the mist cleared and the sun came out, for the first time in days. In the bay, battleships from the French, British, and American navies formed an honor guard through which the president steamed in a U.S. Navy transport ship, the George Washington. Guns thundered a salute, and a band played the Star-Spangled Banner. It was a solemn moment for Gus. Wilson had come here to make sure there would never be another war like the one just ended. Wilson's 14 points and his League of Nations were intended to change forever the way nations resolved their conflicts. It was a stratospheric ambition. In the history of human civilization, no politician had ever aimed so high. If he succeeded, the world would be made new. At 3 in the afternoon, the First Lady, Ethel Wilson, walked down the gangplank on the arm of General Pershing, followed by the President in a top hat. The town of Brest received Wilson as a conquering hero. "Vive Wilson," said the banners, "défenseur du droit des peuples." "Long live Wilson, defender of people's rights." Every building flew the stars and stripes. Crowds jammed the sidewalks, many of the women wearing the traditional Breton tall lace headdress. The sound of Breton bagpipes was everywhere. Gus could have done without the bagpipes. The French foreign minister made a speech of welcome. Gus stood with the American journalists. He noticed a small woman wearing a big fur hat. She turned her head, and he saw that her pretty face was marred by one permanently closed eye. He smiled with delight. It was Rosa Hellman. He looked forward to hearing her view of the peace conference. After the speeches, the entire presidential party boarded the night train for the 400-mile journey to Paris. The president shook Gus's hand and said, "Glad to have you back on the team, Gus." Wilson wanted familiar associates around him for the Paris peace conference. His main advisor would be Colonel House, the pale Texan who had been unofficially counseling him on foreign policy for years. Gus would be the junior member of the crew. Wilson looked weary, and he and Edith retired to their suite. Gus was concerned. He had heard rumors that the president's health was poor. Back in 1906, a blood vessel had burst behind Wilson's left eye, causing temporary blindness, and the doctors had diagnosed high blood pressure and advised him to retire. Wilson had cheerfully ignored their advice and gone on to become president, of course, but lately he had been suffering from headaches that might be a new symptom of the same blood pressure problem. The peace conference would be taxing. Gus hoped Wilson could stand it. Rosa was on the train. Gus sat opposite her on the brocaded upholstery in the dining car. "I wondered whether I might see you," she said. She seemed pleased they had met. "I'm on detachment from the army," said Gus, who was still wearing the uniform of a captain. "Back home, Wilson has been walloped for his choice of colleagues. Not you, of course." "I'm a small fish. But some people say he should not have brought his wife." Gus shrugged. It seemed trivial. After the battlefield, it was going to be difficult to take seriously some of the stuff people worried about in peacetime. Rosa said, "More importantly, he hasn't brought any Republicans." "He wants allies on his team, not enemies," Gus said indignantly. "He needs allies back home, too," Rosa said. "He's lost Congress." She had a point, and Gus was reminded how smart she was. The midterm elections had been disastrous for Wilson. The Republicans had gained control of the Senate and the House of Representatives. "How did that happen?" he said. "I've been out of touch. Ordinary people are fed up with rationing and high prices, and the end of the war came just a bit too late to help. And the liberals hate the Espionage Act. It allowed Wilson to jail people who disagreed with the war. He used it, too. Eugene Debs was sentenced to 10 years. Debs had been a presidential candidate for the Socialists. Rosa sounded angry as she said, "You can't put your opponents in jail and still pretend to believe in freedom." Gus remembered how much he enjoyed the cut and thrust of an argument with Rosa. "Freedom sometimes has to be compromised in war," he said. "Obviously American voters don't think so. And there's another thing. Wilson segregated his Washington offices." Gus did not know whether Negroes could ever be raised to the level of white people, but, like most liberal Americans, he thought the way to find out was to give them better chances in life and see what happened. However, Wilson and his wife were Southerners, and felt differently. "Edith won't take her maid to London for fear the girl will get spoiled," Gus said. "She says British people are too polite to Negroes." "Woodrow Wilson is no longer the darling of the left in America," Rosa concluded, "which means he's going to need Republican support for his League of Nations. I suppose Henry Cabot Lodge feels snubbed." Lodge was a right-wing Republican. "You know politicians," Rosa said. "They're as sensitive as schoolgirls, and more vengeful. Lodge is chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Wilson should have brought him to Paris." Gus protested. "Lodge is against the whole idea of the League of Nations. The ability to listen to smart people who disagree with you is a rare talent, but a president should have it. And bringing Lodge here would have neutralized him. As a member of the team, he couldn't go home and fight against whatever is agreed in Paris." Gus guessed she was right. But Wilson was an idealist who believed that the force of righteousness would overcome all obstacles. He underestimated the need to flatter, cajole, and seduce. The food was good, in honor of the president. They had fresh sole from the Atlantic in a buttery sauce. Gus had not eaten so well since before the war. He was amused to see Rosa tuck in heartily. She was a petite figure. Where did she put it all? At the end of the meal, they were served strong coffee in small cups. Gus found he did not want to leave Rosa and retire to his sleeping compartment. He was much too interested in talking to her. "Wilson will be in a strong position in Paris anyway," he said. Rosa looked skeptical. "How so?" "Well, first of all, we won the war for them." She nodded. "Wilson said, 'At Chateau Thierry, we saved the world.' Chuck Dixon and I were in that battle."
"Was that where he died?"
"Direct hit from a shell. First casualty I saw. Not the last, sadly."
"I'm very sorry. Especially for his wife. I've known Doris for years. We used to have the same piano teacher."
"I don't know if we saved the world, though," Gus went on. "There are many more French and British and Russians among the dead than Americans. But we tipped the balance. That ought to mean something." She shook her head, tossing her dark curls.
"I disagree. The war is over, and the Europeans no longer need us."
"Men such as Lloyd George seem to think that American military power cannot be ignored."
"Then he's wrong," said Rosa.
Gus was surprised and intrigued to hear a woman speak so forcefully about such a subject. "Suppose the French and British simply refuse to go along with Wilson," she said. "Would he use the army to enforce his ideas?"
"No.
Even if he wanted to, a Republican Congress wouldn't let him. We have economic and financial power. It's certainly true that the Allies owe us huge debts, but I'm not sure how much leverage that gives us. There's a saying, if you owe $100, the bank has you in its power, but if you owe $1 million, you have the bank in your power." Gus began to see that Wilson's task might be more difficult than he had imagined. "Well, what about public opinion? You saw the reception Wilson got in Brest. All over Europe, people are looking to him to create a peaceful world."
"That's his strongest card. People are sick of slaughter. Never again is their cry. I just hope Wilson can deliver what they want."
They returned to their compartments and said goodnight. Gus lay awake a long time, thinking about Rosa and what she had said. She really was the smartest woman he had ever met. She was beautiful, too. Somehow you quickly forgot about her eye. At first it seemed a terrible deformity, but after a while Gus stopped noticing it. She had been pessimistic about the conference, however, and everything she said was true. Wilson had a struggle ahead, Gus now realized. He was overjoyed to be part of the team, and determined to do what he could to turn the president's ideals into reality. In the small hours of the morning he looked out of the window as the train steamed eastward across France. Passing through a town, he was startled to see crowds on the station platform and on the road beside the railway line, watching. It was dark, but they were clearly visible by lamplight. There were thousands of them, men and women and children. There was no cheering. They were quite silent. The men and boys took off their hats, Gus saw, and that gesture of respect moved him almost to tears. They had waited half the night to see the passing of the train that held the hope of the world.
Chapter 35. December 1918 to February 1919. The votes were counted 3 days after Christmas. F. and Bernie Leckwith stood in Aldgate Town Hall to hear the results, Bernie on the platform in his best suit, F. in the audience. Bernie lost. He was stoical, but Ethel cried. For him it was the end of a dream. Perhaps it had been a foolish dream, but all the same he was hurt, and her heart ached for him. The Liberal candidate had supported the Lloyd George coalition, so there had been no Conservative candidate. Consequently, the Conservatives had voted Liberal, and the combination had been too much for Labour to beat. Bernie congratulated his winning opponent and came down off the platform. The other Labour Party members had a bottle of scotch and wanted to hold a wake, but Bernie and Ethel went home. "I'm not cut out for this, Eth," Bernie said as she boiled water for cocoa. "You did a good job," she said. "We were outwitted by that bloody Lloyd George." Bernie shook his head. "I'm not a leader," he said. "I'm a thinker and a planner. Time and again I try to talk to people the way you do, and fire them with enthusiasm for our cause, but I never could do it. When you talk to them, they love you. That's the difference." She knew he was right. Next morning, the newspaper showed that the Aldgate result had been mirrored all over the country. The coalition had won 525 of the 707 seats, one of the largest majorities in the history of Parliament. The people had voted for the man who won the war. Ethel was bitterly disappointed. The old men were still running the country. The politicians who had caused millions of deaths were now celebrating, as if they had done something wonderful. But what had they achieved? Pain and hunger and destruction. 10 million men and boys had been killed to no purpose. The only glimmer of hope was that the Labour Party had improved its position. They had won 60 seats, up from 42. It was the anti-Lloyd George Liberals who had suffered. They had won only 30 constituencies, and Asquith himself had lost his seat. "This could be the end of the Liberal Party," said Bernie, as he spread dripping on his bread for lunch. "They failed the people, and Labour is the opposition there. That may be our only consolation." Just before they left for work, the post arrived. Ethel looked at the letters, while Bernie tied the laces of Lloyd's shoes. There was one from Billy written in their code. She sat at the kitchen table to decode it. She underlined the key words with a pencil and wrote them on a pad. As she deciphered the message, she became more and more fascinated. "You know Billy's in Russia?" she said to Bernie.
"Yes. Well, he says our army is there to fight against the Bolsheviks. The American army is there, too."
"I'm not surprised."
"Yes, but listen, Bern," she said. "We know the whites can't beat the Bolsheviks, but what if foreign armies join in? Anything could happen."
Bernie looked thoughtful.
"They could bring back the monarchy. The people of this country won't stand for that. The people of this country don't know what's going on."
"Then we'd better tell them," said Ethel. "I'm going to write an article."
"Who will publish it?"
"We'll see. Maybe the Daily Herald."
The Herald was left-wing.
"Will you take Lloyd to the childminder?"
"Yes, of course."
Ethel thought for a minute. Then, at the top of a sheet of paper, she wrote, "Hands off Russia." 2. Walking around, Paris made Maud cry. Along the broad boulevards there were piles of rubble where German shells had fallen. Broken windows in the grand buildings were repaired with boards, reminding her painfully of her handsome brother with his disfigured eye. The avenues of trees were marred by gaps where an ancient chestnut or noble plane had been sacrificed for its timber. Half the women wore black for mourning, and on street corners crippled soldiers begged for change. She was crying for Walter, too. She had received no reply to her letter. She had inquired about going to Germany, but that was impossible. It had been difficult enough to get permission to come to Paris. She had hoped Walter might come here with the German delegation, but there was no German delegation. The defeated countries were not invited to the peace conference. The victorious allies intended to thrash out an agreement among themselves, then present the losers with a treaty for signing. Meanwhile, there was a shortage of coal, and all the hotels were freezing cold. She had a suite at the Majestic, where the British delegation was headquartered. To guard against French spies, the British had replaced all the staff with their own people. Consequently, the food was dire: porridge for breakfast, overcooked vegetables, and bad coffee. Wrapped in a pre-war fur coat, Maud went to meet Johnny Remarque at Fouquet's on the Champs-Élysées.
"Thank you for arranging for me to travel to Paris," she said.
"Anything for you, Maud. But why were you so keen to come here?" She was not going to tell the truth.
least of all to someone who loved to gossip.
Shopping,
she said. I haven't bought a new dress for 4 years.
Oh, spare me, he said. There's almost nothing to buy, and what there is costs a fortune. 1,500 francs for a gown. Even Fitz might draw the line there. I think you must have a French paramour.
I wish I did. She changed the subject. I found Fitz's car. Do you know where I might get petrol?
I'll see what I can do.
They ordered lunch. Maud said, Do you think we're really going to make the Germans pay billions in reparations?
They're not in a good position to object, said Johnny. After the Franco-Prussian War, they made France pay 5 billion francs, which the French did in 3 years. And last March, in the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, Germany made the Bolsheviks promise 6 billion marks, although, of course, it won't be paid now. All the same, the Germans' righteous indignation has the hollow ring of hypocrisy.
Maud hated it when people spoke harshly of the Germans. It was as if the fact that they had lost made them beasts. What if we had been the losers? Maud wanted to say, would we have had to say the war was our fault and pay for it all? But we're asking for so much more. 24 billion pounds, we say. And the French put it at almost double that.
It's hard to argue with the French, Johnny said. They owe us 600 million pounds and more to the Americans. But if we deny them German reparations, they'll say they can't pay us.
Can the Germans pay what we're asking?
No. My friend Pozzo Keynes says they could pay about a tenth, 2 billion pounds, though it may cripple their country.
Do you mean John Maynard Keynes, the Cambridge economist?
Yes, we call him Pozzo.
I didn't know he was one of your friends.
Johnny smiled. Oh, yes, my dear. Very much so.
Maud suffered a moment of envy for Johnny's cheerful depravity. She had fiercely suppressed her own need for physical love. It was almost 2 years since a man had touched her lovingly. She felt like an old nun, wrinkled and dried up.
What a sad look.
Johnny did not miss much. I hope you're not in love with Pozzo. She laughed, then turned the conversation back to politics. If we know the Germans can't pay, why is Lloyd George insisting?
I asked him that question myself. I've known him quite well since he was Minister for Munitions. He says all the belligerents will end up paying their own debts, and no one will get any reparations to speak of.
So why this pretense?
Because in the end the taxpayers of every country will pay for the war, but the politician who tells them that will never win another election.
3. Gus went to the daily meetings of the League of Nations Commission. This group had the job of drafting the covenant that would set up the League. Woodrow Wilson himself chaired the committee, and he was in a hurry. Wilson had completely dominated the first month of the conference. He had swept aside a French agenda, putting German reparations at the top and the League at the bottom, and insisted that the League must be part of any treaty signed by him. The League Commission met at the luxurious Hôtel Crillon on the Place de la Concorde. The hydraulic elevators were ancient and slow, and sometimes stopped between floors while the water pressure built up. Gus thought they were very like the European diplomats, who enjoyed nothing more than a leisurely argument and never came to a decision until forced. He saw, with secret amusement, that both diplomats and lifts caused the American president to fidget and mutter in furious impatience. The 19 commissioners sat around a big table, covered with a red cloth, their interpreters behind them whispering in their ears, their aides around the room with files and notebooks. Gus could tell that the Europeans were impressed by his boss's ability to drive the agenda forward. Some people had said the writing of the covenant would take months, if not years, and others said the nations would never reach agreement. However, to Gus's delight, after 10 days they were close to completing a first draft. Wilson had to return to the United States on February 14th. He would be back soon, but he was determined to have a draft of the covenant to take home. Unfortunately, the afternoon before he left, the French produced a major obstacle. They proposed that the League of Nations should have its own army. Wilson's eyes rolled up in despair.
Impossible, he groaned.
Gus knew why. Congress would not allow American troops to be under someone else's control. The French delegate, former Prime Minister Léon Bourgeois, argued that the League would be ignored if it had no means of enforcing its decisions. Gus shared Wilson's frustration. There were other ways for the League to put pressure on rogue nations, diplomacy, economic sanctions, and in the last resort an ad hoc army, to be used for a specific mission, then disbanded when the job was done.
But Bourgeois said none of that would have protected France from Germany. The French could not focus on anything else. Perhaps it was understandable, Gus thought, but it was not the way to create a new world order. Lord Robert Cecil, who had done a lot of the drafting, raised a bony finger to speak. Wilson nodded. He liked Cecil, who was a strong supporter of the League. Not everyone agreed. Clemenceau, the French Prime Minister, said that when Cecil smiled he looked like a Chinese dragon. "Forgive me for being blunt," Cecil said. "The French delegation seems to be saying that because the League may not be as strong as they hoped, they will reject it altogether. May I point out very frankly that in that case there will almost certainly be a bilateral alliance between Great Britain and the United States that would offer nothing to France." Gus suppressed a smile. "That's Sallingham," he thought. Bourgeois looked shocked and withdrew his amendment. Wilson shot a grateful look across the table at Cecil. The Japanese delegate, Baron Makino, wanted to speak. Wilson nodded and looked at his watch. Makino referred to the clause in the covenant, already agreed, that guaranteed religious freedom. He wished to add an amendment to the effect that all members would treat each other's citizens equally, without racial discrimination. Wilson's face froze. Makino's speech was eloquent, even in translation. Different races had fought side by side in the war, he pointed out. A common bond of sympathy and gratitude has been established. The League would be a great family of nations. Surely they should treat one another as equals. Gus was worried, but not surprised. The Japanese had been talking about this for a week or two. It had already caused consternation among the Australians and the Californians, who wanted to keep the Japanese out of their territories. It had disconcerted Wilson, who did not, for one moment, think that American Negroes were his equals. Most of all, it had upset the British, who ruled undemocratically over hundreds of millions of people of different races and did not want them to think they were as good as their white overlords. Again, it was Cecil who spoke. "Alas, this is a highly controversial matter," he said, and Gus could almost have believed in his sadness. "The mere suggestion that it might be discussed has already created discord." There was a murmur of agreement around the table. Cecil went on, "Rather than delay the agreement of a draft covenant, perhaps we should postpone discussion of racial discrimination to a later date." The Greek Prime Minister said, "The whole question of religious liberty is a tricky subject, too. Perhaps we should drop that for the present." The Portuguese delegate said, "My government has never yet signed a treaty that did not call on God." Cecil, a deeply religious man, said, "Perhaps this time we will all have to take a chance." There was a ripple of laughter, and Wilson said with evident relief, "If that's agreed, let us move on." 4. Next day Wilson went to the French Foreign Ministry at the Quai d'Orsay and read the draft to a plenary session of the peace conference in the famous clock room, under the enormous chandeliers that looked like stalactites in an Arctic cave. That evening he left for home. The following day was a Saturday, and in the evening Gus went dancing. Paris after dark was a party town. Food was still scarce, but there seemed to be plenty of booze. Young men left their hotel room doors open so that Red Cross nurses could wander in whenever they needed company. Conventional morality seemed to be put on hold. People did not try to hide their love affairs. Effeminate men cast off the pretense of masculinity. La Rouge became the lesbian restaurant. It was said the coal shortage was a myth put about by the French so that everyone would keep warm at night by sleeping with their friends. Everything was expensive, but Gus had money. He had other advantages, too. He knew Paris and could speak French. He went to the races at Saint-Cloud, saw La Bohème at the opera, and went to a risque musical called Fifi. Because he was close to the president, he was invited to every party. He found himself spending more and more time with Rosa Hellman. He had to be careful, when talking to her, to tell her only things that he would be happy to see printed. But the habit of discretion was automatic with him now. She was one of the smartest people he had ever met. He liked her, but that was as far as it went. She was always ready to go out with him, but what reporter would refuse an invitation from a presidential aide? He could never hold hands with her, or try to kiss her goodnight, in case she might think he was taking advantage of his position as someone she could not afford to offend. He met her at the Ritz for cocktails. "What are cocktails?" she said. "Hard liquor dressed up to be more respectable. I promise you, they're fashionable." Rosa was fashionable too.
Her hair was bobbed. Her cloche hat came down over her ears like a German soldier's steel helmet. Curves and corsets had gone out of style, and her draped dress fell straight from the shoulders to a startlingly low waistline. By concealing her shape, paradoxically, the dress made Gus think about the body beneath. She wore lipstick and face powder, something European women still considered daring. They had a martini each, then moved on. They drew a lot of stares as they walked together through the long lobby of the Ritz. The lanky man with the big head and his tiny, one-eyed companion, him in white tie and tails, and her in silver-blue silk. They got a cab to the Majestic, where the British held Saturday night dances that everyone went to. The ballroom was packed. Young aides from the delegations, journalists from all over the world, and soldiers freed from the trenches were jazzing with nurses and typists. Rosa taught Gus the foxtrot. Then she left him and danced with a handsome, dark-eyed man from the Greek delegation. Feeling jealous, Gus drifted around the room, chatting to acquaintances, until he ran into Lady Maud Fitzherbert in a purple dress and pointed shoes. "Hello," he said in surprise. She seemed pleased to see him. "You look well." "I was lucky. I'm all in one piece." She touched the scar on his cheek. "Almost. A scratch. Shall we dance?" He took her in his arms. She was thin. He could feel her bones through the dress. They did the hesitation waltz. "How is Fitz?" Gus asked. "Fine, I think. He's in Russia. I'm probably not supposed to say that, but it's an open secret. I noticed the British newspapers saying, 'Hands off Russia.' That campaign is being led by a woman you met at T. Gwynn, Ethel Williams, now F. Leckwith. I don't remember her. She was the housekeeper." "Good Lord. She's becoming something of a force in British politics. How the world has changed." Maud drew him closer and lowered her voice. "I don't suppose you have any news of Walter?" Gus recalled the familiar-looking German officer he had seen fall at Chateau Thierry, but he was far from certain that had been Walter, so he said, "Nothing, I'm sorry. It must be hard for you." "No information is coming out of Germany, and no one is allowed to go there. I'm afraid you may have to wait until the peace treaty is signed."
"And when will that be?"
Gus did not know. "The League Covenant is pretty much done, but they're a long way from agreement over how much Germany should pay in reparations."
"It's foolish," Maud said bitterly. "We need the Germans to be prosperous, so that British factories can sell them cars and stoves and carpet sweepers. If we cripple their economy, Germany will go Bolshevik.
People want revenge.
Do you remember 1914? Walter didn't want war, nor did the majority of Germans. But the country wasn't a democracy. The Kaiser was egged on by the generals, and once the Russians had mobilized, they had no choice."
"Of course I remember, but most people don't." The dance ended. Rosa Hallman appeared, and Gus introduced the two women. They talked for a minute, but Rosa was uncharacteristically charmless, and Maud moved away.
"That dress cost a fortune," Rosa said grumpily. "It's by Jean Lanvin."
Gus was perplexed. "Didn't you like Maud?"
"You obviously do."
"What do you mean?"
"You were dancing very close."
Rosa did not know about Walter. All the same, Gus resented being falsely accused of flirting. She wanted to talk about something rather confidential, he said with a touch of indignation.
"I bet she did."
"I don't know why you're taking this attitude," Gus said. "You went off with that oily Greek."
"He's very handsome and not a bit oily. Why shouldn't I dance with other men? It's not as if you're in love with me."
Gus stared at her.
"Oh," he said.
"Oh, dear." He suddenly felt confused and uncertain.
"What's the matter now?"
"I've just realized something, I think."
"Are you going to tell me what it is?"
"I suppose I must," he said shakily. He paused. She waited for him to speak.
"Well?"
she said impatiently. "I am in love with you." She looked back at him in silence. After a long pause, she said,
"Do you mean it?"
Although the thought had taken him by surprise, he had no doubt.
"Yes, I love you, Rosa."
She smiled weakly.
"Just fancy that.
I think perhaps I've been in love with you for quite a long time without knowing it." She nodded, as if having a suspicion confirmed. The band started a slow tune. She moved closer. He took her in his arms automatically, but he was too wrought up to dance properly. "I'm not sure I can manage."
"Don't worry."
She knew what he was thinking.
"Just pretend."
He shuffled a few steps.
His mind was in turmoil. She had not said anything about her own feelings. On the other hand, she had not walked away. Was there any chance she might return his love? She obviously liked him, but that was not the same thing at all. Was she asking herself at this very minute how she felt, or was she thinking up some gentle words of rejection? She looked up at him, and he thought she was about to give him the answer. Then she said, "Take me away from here, please, Gus." "Of course." She got her coat. The doorman summoned a red Renault taxi. "Maxim's," Gus said. It was a short drive, and they rode in silence. Gus longed to know what was in her mind, but he did not rush her. She would have to tell him soon. The restaurant was packed, the few empty tables reserved for later customers. The head waiter was désolé. Gus took out his wallet, extracted a 100-franc note, and said, "A quiet table in a corner." A card saying, "Réservé," was whipped away, and they sat down. They chose a light supper, and Gus ordered a bottle of champagne. "You've changed so much," Rosa said. He was surprised. "I don't think so." "You were a diffident young man back in Buffalo. I think you were even shy of me. Now you walk around Paris as if you own it." "Oh, dear. That sounds arrogant." "No, just confident. After all, you've worked for a president and fought a war. Those things make a difference." The food came, but neither of them ate much. Gus was too tense. What was she thinking? Did she love him or not? Surely she must know. He put down his knife and fork, but instead of asking her the question on his mind, he said, "You've always seemed self-confident." She laughed. "Isn't that amazing?" "Why?" "I suppose I was confident until about the age of 7, and then, well, you know what schoolgirls are like. Everyone wants to be friends with the prettiest. I had to play with the fat girls and the ugly ones and those dressed in hand-me-downs. That went on into my teenage years. Even working for the Buffalo Anarchist was kind of an outsider thing to do. But when I became editor, I started to get my self-esteem back." She took a sip of champagne. "You helped."
"I did."
Gus was surprised. "It was the way you talked to me, as if I was the smartest and most interesting person in Buffalo." "You probably were. Except for Olga Vyalov."
"Ah."
Gus blushed. Remembering his infatuation with Olga made him feel foolish. But he did not want to say so, for that would be running her down, which was ungentlemanly. When they had finished their coffee and he called for the bill, he still did not know how Rosa felt about him. In the taxi, he took her hand and pressed it to his lips. She said,
"Oh, Gus, you are very dear."
He did not know what she meant by that. However, her face was turned up toward him in a way that almost seemed expectant. Did she want him to? He screwed up his nerve and kissed her mouth. There was a frozen moment when she did not respond, and he thought he had done the wrong thing. Then she sighed contentedly and parted her lips.
"Oh,"
he thought happily, "so that's all right then." He put his arms around her and they kissed all the way to her hotel. The journey was too short. Suddenly a commissionaire was opening the door of the cab.
"Wipe your mouth,"
Rosa said as she got out. Gus pulled out a handkerchief and hastily rubbed at his face. The white linen came away red with her lipstick. He folded it carefully and put it back in his pocket. He walked her to the door.
"Can I see you tomorrow?"
he said.
"When?"
"Early." She laughed. "You never pretend, Gus, do you?
I love that about you."
That was good. "I love that about you" was not the same as "I love you," but it was better than nothing.
"Early it is,"
he said.
"What shall we do?"
"It's Sunday." He said the first thing that came into his head.
"We could go to church."
"All right. Let me take you to Notre Dame."
"Are you a Catholic?"
she said in surprise.
"No, a Episcopalian, if anything."
"You?"
"The same."
"It's all right, we can sit at the back. I'll find out what time Mass is and phone your hotel." She held out her hand, and they shook like friends.
"Thank you for a lovely evening,"
she said formally. "It was such a pleasure. Good night."
"Good night,"
she said, and she turned away and disappeared into the hotel lobby. Chapter 36. March to April 1919. When the snow melted and the iron-hard Russian earth turned to rich wet mud, the white armies made a mighty effort to rid their country of the curse of Bolshevism.
Admiral Kolchak's force of 100,000, patchily supplied with British uniforms and guns, came storming out of Siberia and attacked the Reds over a front that stretched 700 miles from north to south. Fitz followed a few miles behind the Whites. He was leading the Aberowan Pals, plus some Canadians and a few interpreters. His job was to stiffen Kolchak by supervising communications, intelligence, and supply. Fitz had high hopes. There might be difficulties, but it was unimaginable that Lenin and Trotsky would be allowed to steal Russia. At the beginning of March, he was in the city of Ufa, on the European side of the Ural Mountains, reading a batch of week-old British newspapers. The news from London was mixed. Fitz was delighted that Lloyd George had appointed Winston Churchill as Secretary for War. Of all the leading politicians, Winston was the most vigorous supporter of intervention in Russia. But some of the papers took the opposite side. Fitz was not surprised by the Daily Herald and the New Statesman, which in his view were more or less Bolshevik publications anyway. But even the conservative Daily Express had a headline reading, "Withdrawal from Russia." Unfortunately, they also had accurate details of what was going on. They even knew that the British had helped Kolchak with the coup that had abolished the Directorate and made him supreme ruler. Where were they getting the information? He looked up from the paper. He was quartered in the city's commercial college, and his aide-de-camp sat at the opposite desk. "Murray," he said, "next time there's a batch of mail from the men to be sent home, bring it to me first." This was irregular, and Murray looked dubious. "Sir?" Fitz thought he had better explain. "I suspect information may be getting back from here. The censor must be asleep at the wheel. Perhaps they think they can slacken off now that the war in Europe has ended. No doubt. Anyway, I want to see whether the leak is in our section of the pipe." The back page of the paper had a photograph of the woman leading the Hands Off Russia campaign, and Fitz was startled to see that it was Ethel. She had been a housemaid at T. Gwynne, but now, the Express said, she was General Secretary of the National Garment Workers' Union. He had slept with many women since then, most recently in Omsk, a stunning Russian blonde, the board mistress of a fat Tsarist general who was too drunk and lazy to fuck her himself. But Ethel shone out in his memory. He wondered what her child was like. Fitz probably had half a dozen bastards around the world, but Ethel's was the only one he knew of for sure. And she was the one whipping up protest against intervention in Russia. Now Fitz knew where the information was coming from. Her damn brother was a sergeant in the Aberowan Pals. He had always been a troublemaker, and Fitz had no doubt he was briefing Ethel. "Well," Fitz thought, "I'll catch him out, and then there will be hell to pay." Over the next few weeks, the Whites raced ahead, driving before them the surprised Reds, who had thought the Siberian government a spent force. If Kolchak's armies could link up with their supporters in Archangel in the north, and with Denikin's volunteer army in the south, they would form a semicircular force, a curved eastern scimitar 1,000 miles long that would sweep irresistibly to Moscow. Then, at the end of April, the Reds counterattacked. By then Fitz was in Bugaruslan, a grimly impoverished town in forest country 100 miles or so east of the Volga River. The few dilapidated stone churches and municipal buildings poked up over the roofs of low-built wooden houses, like weeds in a rubbish dump. Fitz sat in a large room in the town hall with the intelligence unit, sifting reports of prisoner interrogations. He did not know anything was wrong until he looked out of the window and saw the ragged soldiers of Kolchak's army streaming along the main road through the town in the wrong direction. He sent an American interpreter, Lev Peshkov, to question the retreating men. Peshkov came back with a sorry story. The Reds had attacked in force from the south, striking the overstretched left flank of Kolchak's advancing army. To avoid his force being cut in two, the local White commander, General Belov, had ordered them to retreat and regroup. A few minutes later, a Red deserter was brought in for interrogation. He had been a colonel under the Tsar. What he had to say dismayed Fitz. The Reds had been surprised by Kolchak's offensive, he said, but they had quickly regrouped and resupplied. Trotsky had declared that the Red Army must go on the offensive in the east. "Trotsky thinks that if the Reds falter, the Allies will recognize Kolchak as supreme ruler, and once they have done that, they will flood Siberia with men and supplies." That was exactly what Fitz was hoping for. In his heavily accented Russian, he asked, "So what did Trotsky do?" The reply came fast, and Fitz could not understand what was said until he heard Peshkov's translation. "Trotsky drew on special levies of recruits from the Bolshevik Party and the trade unions.
The response was amazing. 22 provinces sent detachments. The Novgorod Provincial Committee mobilized half its members. Fitz tried to imagine Kolchak summoning such a response from his supporters. It would never happen. He returned to his quarters to pack his kit. He was almost too slow. The pals got out only just ahead of the Reds, and a handful of men were left behind. By that evening, Kolchak's Western Army was in full retreat, and Fitz was on a train going back toward the Ural Mountains. 2 days later, he was back in the Commercial College at Ufa. Over those 2 days, Fitz's mood turned black. He felt bitter with rage. He had been at war for 5 years, and he could recognize the turn of the tide. He knew the signs. The Russian Civil War was as good as over. The Whites were just too weak. The revolutionaries were going to win. Nothing short of an Allied invasion could turn the tables, and that was not going to happen. Churchill was in enough trouble for the little he was doing. Billy Williams and Ethel were making sure the needed reinforcements would never be sent. Murray brought him a sack of mail. "You asked to see the men's letters home, sir," he said, with a hint of disapproval in his tone. Fitz ignored Murray's scruples and opened the sack. He searched for a letter from Sergeant Williams. Someone at least could be punished for this catastrophe. He found what he was looking for. Sergeant Williams's letter was addressed to E. Williams, her maiden name. No doubt he feared the use of her married name would call attention to his traitorous letter. Fitz read it. Billy's handwriting was large and confident. At first sight, the text seemed innocent, if a bit odd. But Fitz had worked in room 40 and knew about codes. He settled down to crack this one. Murray said, "On another matter, sir. Have you seen the American interpreter Peshkov in the last day or two?" "No," Fitz said. "What's happened to him?" "We seem to have lost him, sir." 2. Trotsky was immensely weary but not discouraged. The lines of strain on his face did not diminish the light of hope in his eyes. Grigory thought admiringly that he was sustained by an unshakable belief in what he was doing. They all had that, Grigory suspected. Lenin and Stalin, too. Each felt sure he knew the right thing to do, whatever the problem might be, from land reform to military tactics. Grigory was not like that. With Trotsky, he tried to work out the best response to the White armies, but he never felt sure they had made the right decision until the results were known. Perhaps that was why Trotsky was world famous, and Grigory was just another commissar. As he had many times before, Grigory sat in Trotsky's personal train with a map of Russia on the table. "We hardly need worry about the counter-revolutionaries in the north," Trotsky said. Grigory agreed. "According to our intelligence, there are mutinies among the British soldiers and sailors there, and they have lost all hope of linking up with Kolchak. His armies are running as fast as they can back to Siberia. We could chase them over the Urals, but I think we have more important business elsewhere." "In the west? That's bad enough. The Whites are bolstered by reactionary nationalists in Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. Kolchak has appointed a Danish commander-in-chief there, and he's supported by a British Navy flotilla that is keeping our fleet bottled up in Kronstadt. But I'm even more worried about the south. General Denikin. He has about 150,000 men, supported by French and Italian troops, and supplied by the British. We think he's planning a dash for Moscow. If I may say so, I think the key to defeating him is political, not military." Trotsky looked intrigued. "Go on." "Everywhere he goes, Denikin makes enemies. His Cossacks rob everyone. Whenever he takes a town, he rounds up all the Jews and just shoots them. If the coal mines fail to meet production targets, he kills 1 in 10 miners. And of course, he executes all deserters from his army." "So do we," said Trotsky. "And we kill villagers who harbor deserters, and peasants who refuse to give up their grain." Grigory had had to harden his heart to accept this brutal necessity. "But I know peasants. My father was one. What they care about most is land. A lot of these people gained considerable tracts of land in the revolution, and they want to hold on to it, whatever else happens. So, Kolchak has announced that land reform should be based on the principle of private property, which means the peasants giving back the fields they have taken from the aristocracy. And everyone knows that. I'd like to print his proclamation and post it outside every church. No matter what our soldiers do, the peasants will prefer us to the Whites." "Do it," said Trotsky. "One more thing. Announce an amnesty for deserters. For 7 days.
any who return to the ranks will escape punishment. Another political move. I don't believe it will encourage desertion, because it's only for a week. But it might bring men back to us, especially when they find out the whites want to take their land. Give it a try, said Trotsky. An aide came in and saluted. A strange report, Comrade Peshkov, that I thought you would want to hear. All right. It's about one of the prisoners we took at Bugoruslan. He was with Kolchak's army but wearing an American uniform. The whites have soldiers from all over the world. The capitalist imperialists support the counter-revolution, naturally. It's not that, sir. What then? Sir, he says he's your brother.
3. The platform was long, and there was a heavy morning mist, so that Grigori could not see the far end of the train. There was probably some mistake, he thought, a confusion of names or an error of translation. He tried to steel himself for a disappointment, but he was not successful. His heart beat faster and his nerves seemed to tingle. It was almost 5 years since he had seen his brother. He had often thought Lev must be dead. That could still be the awful truth. He walked slowly, peering into the swirling haze. If this really was Lev, he would naturally be different. In the last 5 years, Grigori had lost a front tooth and most of one ear, and had probably changed in other ways he was not aware of. How would Lev have altered? After a few moments, two figures emerged from the white mist, a Russian soldier in ragged uniform and homemade shoes, and beside him, a man who looked American. Was that Lev? He had a short American haircut and no mustache. He had the round-faced look of the well-fed American soldiers, with meaty shoulders under the smart new uniform. It was an officer's uniform, Grigori saw with growing incredulity. Could his brother be an American officer? The prisoner was staring back at him, and as Grigori came close he saw that it was, indeed, his brother. He did look different, and it was not just the general air of sleek prosperity. It was the way he stood, the expression on his face, and most of all the look in his eyes. He had lost his boyish cockiness and acquired an air of caution. He had, in fact, grown up. As they came within touching distance, Grigori thought of all the ways Lev had let him down, and a host of recriminations sprang to his lips. But he uttered none of them, and instead opened his arms and hugged Lev. They kissed cheeks, slapped each other on the back, and hugged again, and Grigori found that he was weeping. After a while, he led Lev onto the train and took him to the carriage he used as his office. Grigori told his aide to bring tea. They sat in two faded armchairs.
"You're in the army?" Grigori said incredulously.
"They have conscription in America," Lev said. That made sense. Lev would never have joined voluntarily.
"And you're an officer?"
"So are you," said Lev. Grigori shook his head. "We've abolished ranks in the Red Army. I'm a military commissar." "But there are still some men who order tea and others who bring it," Lev said as the aide came in with cups.
"Wouldn't Ma be proud? Fit to bust. But why did you never write to me? I thought you were dead."
"Oh, hell, I'm sorry," said Lev. "I felt so bad about taking your ticket that I wanted to write and say I can pay for your passage. I kept putting off the letter until I had more money."
It was a feeble excuse, but characteristic of Lev. He would not go to a party unless he had a fancy jacket to put on, and he refused to enter a bar if he did not have the money to buy a round of drinks. Grigori recalled another betrayal.
"You didn't tell me Katerina was pregnant when you left."
"Pregnant? I didn't know."
"Yes, you did. You told her not to tell me."
"Oh, I guess I forgot."
Lev looked foolish, caught in a lie, but it did not take him long to recover and come up with his own counter-accusation.
"That ship you sent me on didn't even go to New York. It put us all ashore at a dump called Cardiff. I had to work for months to save up for another ticket."
Grigori even felt guilty for a moment, then recalled how Lev had begged for the ticket.
"Maybe I shouldn't have helped you escape from the police," he said crisply. "I suppose you did your best for me," Lev said reluctantly.
Then he gave the warm smile that always caused Grigori to forgive him.
"As you always have," he added, "ever since Ma died."
Grigori felt a lump in his throat.
"All the same,"
he said, concentrating to make his voice steady,
"we ought to punish the Vyala family for cheating us."
"I got my revenge," Lev said. "There's a Joseph Vyalov in Buffalo. I fucked his daughter and made her pregnant.
and he had to let me marry her.
My God, you're part of the Vyalov family now?
He regretted it, which is why he arranged for me to be conscripted. He's hoping I'll be killed in battle.
Huh. Do you still go wherever your dick leads you?
Lev shrugged.
I guess.
Grigori had some revelations of his own, and he was nervous about making them. He began by saying carefully,
Katerina had a baby boy, your son. She called him Vladimir.
Lev looked pleased.
Is that so? I've got a son.
Grigori did not have the courage to say that Vladimir knew nothing of Lev, and called Grigori daddy. Instead he said,
I've taken good care of him.
I knew you would.
Grigori felt a familiar stab of indignation at how Lev assumed that others would pick up the responsibilities he dropped.
Lev, he said, I married Katerina.
He waited for the outraged reaction, but Lev remained calm.
I knew you'd do that, too.
Grigori was astonished.
What?
Lev nodded.
You were crazy for her, and she needed a solid, dependable type to raise the child. It was in the cards.
I went through agonies, Grigori said.
Had all that been for nothing?
I was tortured by the thought that I was being disloyal to you.
Hell no. I left her in the lurch. Good luck to you both.
Grigori was maddened by how casual Lev was about the whole thing.
Did you worry about us at all?
He asked pointedly.
You know me, Grishka?
Of course Lev had not worried about them.
You hardly thought about us.
Sure I thought about you. Don't be so holy. You wanted her. You held off for a while, maybe for years. But in the end you fucked her.
It was the crude truth. Lev had an annoying way of bringing everyone else down to his level.
You're right, Grigori said. Anyway, we have another child now, a daughter, Anna. She's a year and a half old.
Two adults and two children.
It doesn't matter. I've got enough. What are you talking about?
I've been making money, selling whiskey from British army stores to the Cossacks for gold. I've accumulated a small fortune.
Lev reached inside his uniform shirt, unfastened a buckle, and pulled out a money belt.
There's enough here to pay for all four of you to come to America.
He gave the belt to Grigori. Grigori was astonished and moved. Lev had not forgotten his family after all. He had saved up for a ticket. Naturally, the handing over of the money had to be a flamboyant gesture. That was Lev's character. But he had kept his promise. What a shame it was all for nothing.
Thank you, Grigori said. I'm proud of you for doing what you said you'd do. But of course, it's not necessary now. I can get you released and help you return to normal Russian life.
He handed the money belt back. Lev took it and held it in his hands, staring at it.
What do you mean?
Grigori saw that Lev looked hurt, and understood that he was wounded by the refusal of his gift. But there was a greater worry on Grigori's mind. What would happen when Lev and Katerina were reunited? Would she fall for the more attractive brother all over again? Grigori's heart was chilled by the thought that he could lose her after all they had been through together.
We live in Moscow now, he said. We have an apartment in the Kremlin, Katerina and Vladimir and Anna and me. I can get an apartment for you easily enough.
Wait a minute, said Lev, and there was a look of incredulity on his face.
You think I want to come back to Russia?
You already have, Grigori said, but not to stay. You can't possibly want to return to America.
Of course I do. And you should come with me.
But there's no need. Russia's not like it used to be. The Tsar is gone.
I like America, Lev said. You'll like it too, all of you, especially Katerina. But we're making history here. We've invented a new form of government, the Soviet. This is the new Russia, the new world. You're missing everything.
You're the one who doesn't understand, Lev said. In America, I have my own car. There's more food than you can eat. All the booze I want, all the cigarettes I can smoke. I have 5 suits.
What's the point in having 5 suits?
Grigori said in frustration.
It's like having 5 beds. You can only use one at a time.
That's not how I see it.
What made the conversation so aggravating was that Lev clearly thought Grigori was the one who was missing the point. Grigori did not know what more he could say to change his brother's mind.
Is that really what you want? Cigarettes and too many clothes and a car?
It's what everyone wants. You Bolsheviks better remember that.
Grigori was not going to take lessons in politics from Lev.
Russians want bread, peace, and land.
Anyway, I have a daughter in America. Her name is Daisy. She's 3.
Grigori frowned doubtfully.
I know what you're thinking, Lev said. I didn't care about Katerina's child. What's his name?
Vladimir.
I didn't care about him, you think. So why should I care about Daisy?
But it's different.
I never met Vladimir. He was just a speck when I left Petrograd. But I love Daisy, and what's more, she loves me.
Grigori could at least understand that. He was glad Lev had a good enough heart to feel attached to his daughter. And although he was bewildered by Lev's preference for America, in his heart he would be hugely relieved if Lev did not come home. For Lev would surely want to get to know Vladimir, and then how long would it be before Vladimir learned that Lev was his real father? And if Katerina decided to leave Grigori for Lev, and take Vladimir with her, what would happen to Anna? Would Grigori lose her too? For himself, he thought guiltily, it was much better if Lev went back to America alone.
I believe you're making the wrong choice, but I'm not going to force you, he said.
Lev grinned.
You're afraid I'll take Katerina back, aren't you? I know you too well, brother.
Grigori winced.
Yes, he said. Take her back, then discard her all over again, and leave me to pick up the pieces a second time. I know you too, but you'll help me get back to America.
No. Grigori could not help feeling a twitch of gratification at the look of fear that passed across Lev's face, but he did not prolong the agony.
I'll help you get back to the White Army. They can take you to America.
What'll we do?
We'll drive to the front line and a little beyond it. Then I'll release you into no man's land. After that, you're on your own.
I might get shot.
We both might get shot. It's a war.
I guess I'll have to take my chances.
You'll be okay, Lev, said Grigori. You always are.
4. Billy Williams was marched from the Ufa City Jail, through the dusty streets of the city, to the commercial college being used as temporary accommodation by the British Army. The court-martial took place in a classroom. Fitz sat at the teacher's desk with his aide-de-camp, Captain Murray, beside him. Captain Gwyn Evans was there with a notebook and pencil. Billy was dirty and unshaven, and he had slept badly with the drunks and prostitutes of the town. Fitz wore a perfectly pressed uniform, as always. Billy knew he was in bad trouble. The verdict was a foregone conclusion. The evidence was clear. He had revealed military secrets in coded letters to his sister. But he was determined not to let his fear show. He was going to give a good account of himself. Fitz said, "This is a field general court-martial, permitted when the accused is on active service or overseas, and it is not possible to hold the more regular general court-martial. Only 3 officers are required to sit as judges, or 2 if no more are available. It may try a soldier of any rank on any offence, and has the power to impose the death penalty." Billy's only chance was to influence the sentence. The possible punishments included penal servitude, hard labour, and death. No doubt Fitz would like to put Billy in front of a firing squad, or at least give him several years in prison. Billy's aim was to plant in the minds of Murray and Evans sufficient doubts about the fairness of the trial to make them plump for a short term in prison. Now he said, "Where is my lawyer?" "It is not possible to offer you legal representation," Fitz said.
"You're sure of that, are you, sir?"
"Speak when you're spoken to, Sergeant."
Billy said, "Let the record show that I was denied access to a lawyer."
He stared at Gwyn Evans, the only one with a notebook. When Evans did nothing, Billy said, "Oh, will the record of this trial be a lie?" He put heavy emphasis on the word lie, knowing it would offend Fitz. It was part of the code of the English gentleman always to tell the truth. Fitz nodded to Evans, who made a note. "First point to me," Billy thought, and he cheered up a bit. Fitz said, "William Williams, you stand accused under Part 1 of the Army Act. The charge is that you knowingly, while on active service, committed an act calculated to imperil the success of His Majesty's forces. The penalty is death, or such lesser punishment as the court shall impose." The repeated emphasis on the death penalty chilled Billy, but he kept his face stiff. "How do you plead?" Billy took a deep breath. He spoke in a clear voice, and put into his tone as much scorn and contempt as he could muster. "I plead, how dare you?" he said. "How dare you pretend to be an objective judge? How dare you act as if our presence in Russia is a legitimate operation? And how dare you make an accusation of treason against a man who has fought alongside you for 3 years? That's how I plead." Gwyn Evans said, "Don't be insolent, Billy boy. You'll only make it worse for yourself. Billy was not going to let Evans pretend to be benevolent. He said, "And my advice to you is to leave now and have nothing more to do with this kangaroo court. When the news gets out, and believe you me, this is going to be on the front page of the Daily Mirror, you will find that you're the one in disgrace, not me." He looked at Murray. "Every man who has anything to do with this farce is going to be disgraced." Evans looked troubled. Clearly he had not thought there might be publicity. "Enough," said Fitz loudly and angrily. "Good," Billy thought. "I've got his goat already." Fitz went on. "Let's have the evidence, please, Captain Murray." Murray opened a folder and took out a sheet of paper. Billy recognized his own handwriting. It was, as he expected, a letter to Ethel. Murray showed it to him and said, "Did you write this letter?" Billy said, "How did it come to your attention, Captain Murray?" Fitz barked, "Answer the question." Billy said, "You went to Eton school, didn't you, Captain? A gentleman would never read someone else's mail, or so we're told. But as I understand it, only the official censor has the right to examine soldiers' letters, so I assume this was brought to your attention by the censor." He paused. As he expected, Murray was unwilling to answer. He went on, "Or was the letter obtained illegally?" Murray repeated, "Did you write this letter? If it was obtained illegally, then it can't be used in a trial. I think that's what a lawyer would say. But there are no lawyers here. That's what makes this a kangaroo court. Did you write this letter? I will answer that question when you have explained how it came into your possession." Fitz said, "You can be punished for contempt of court, you know." "I'm already facing the death penalty," Billy thought. "How stupid of Fitz to think he can threaten me." But he said, "I am defending myself by pointing out the irregularity of the court and the illegality of the prosecution. Are you going to forbid that, sir?" Murray gave up. "The envelope is marked with a return address and the name of Sergeant Billy Williams. If the accused wishes to claim he did not write it, he should say so now." Billy said nothing. "The letter is a coded message," Murray went on. "It may be decoded by reading every third word and the initial capital letters of titles of songs and films." Murray handed the letter to Evans. "When so decoded, it reads as follows." Billy's letter described the incompetence of the Kolchak regime, saying that despite all their gold, they had failed to pay the staff of the Trans-Siberian Railway, and so were continuing to have supply and transport problems. It also detailed the help the British Army was trying to give. The information had been kept secret from the British public, who were paying for the army and whose sons were risking their lives. Murray said to Billy, "Do you deny sending this message?" "I cannot comment on evidence that has been obtained illegally. The addressee, E. Williams, is in fact Mrs. Ethel Leckwith, leader of the Hands Off Russia campaign, is she not? I cannot comment on evidence that has been obtained illegally. Have you written previous coded letters to her?" Billy said nothing. "And she has used the information you gave her to generate hostile newspaper stories, bringing discredit on the British Army and imperiling the success of her actions here.